Ecclesiastes chapter 4. Ecclesiastes chapter 4. On the board behind me, we have the three categories of divine truth. And the first category, of course, is for the that's for all mankind, and that's the divine institutions. The divine institutions are also written out on the board. It's privacy, marriage, family, nationalism. Under nationalism, you have subcomponents of capitalism, which is a critical part of nationalism. You have respect for, well, law and order, which refers to the police officer on the beat and also the judges on the bench. And then you have a strong military that's also set there. The entire book of Numbers is really a military table of contents, or T-O-N-E, table of organization and equipment. The Bible has always endorsed the strong military because that's how national entities survive in this devil's world. So these are the things that make for a vibrant nation, a group of people that come together. And God developed these things for all mankind. So if you have a nation that is composed of unbelievers, they can still have a healthy, thriving, successful society and nation if they follow the divine institutions. The second category of truth, of course, is for the unbeliever only, and that is the gospel. And that will save you. That will take you from point X, where we're all born as unbelievers, into point Y, where you're born again. And you receive 40 things at that second that you're saved. And that's the second category of divine truth. The third category of divine truth, of course, is for believers only. And for believers only, of course, is what we call Bible doctrine. So it's true that part of Bible doctrine is the divine institutions, but and unbelievers can understand those things, but that's as far as they can go because they do not have a human spirit. And so the rest of the Bible is designed for us to know these things because you can't love what you don't know. And therefore, our goal here is to reach maturity because that's what you do. When you're born again at point Y, nobody knows anything. If you come from a religious family, you're actually in worse shape because you have a lot of legalism that's clouded your thinking and your family's thinking for a long time. So it's much better if you're born to a family that's not religious because then you're not all tangled up with legalism and self-righteousness and tabooism and all the other things. But if you're positive to Bible doctrine, you will start to grow up. All of us as children grow up. That's why I use the analogy born again. When you're born again, you're a baby. When you're born, you're a baby. When you're born again, you're a baby. You don't know anything. And of course, you've got to grow up. And growing up requires information and training. So God provides the training and he provides the information. And as you grow, well, first of all, how do you grow? You learn Bible doctrine. You can be 90 years old as a born-again believer and an idiot. You never grew up. How do you grow up as a believer? You have to have food. Babies have to have food to grow up. And then they got to have exercise. Exercise and food, exercise and food. For the believer, you got to have food and exercise. What's the food? Bible doctrine. What's the exercise? Testing. Testing is your exercise. And Bible doctrine is your food. So if you're positive to Bible doctrine in your soul, God will expose you to an accurate Bible teacher. Whoever that person is, they'll drop it in your lap. And then, of course, you have to expose yourself, get the food. As you eat the food, then you're going to have testing. And then you grow. And we have, you know, we've developed a 45-degree angle from point X to point Z, and we're assuming this is a positive believer. Most believers do not have this 45-degree angle. Their physical death would be just a straight line out, and they die. But at some point, well, at the point of salvation, we all start out alike, and we're all glorifying God because we're saved. But only those believers that eat the spiritual food can grow up from a baby to an adult. Remember, Peter and Paul use the same analogy. You're babies. And the writer of Hebrews, same analogy. You're babies. I can't teach you any Bible doctrine because you don't want the food. Remember that? I can't give you the spiritual food. I just give you pablum. And pablum, of course, little babies don't get much test. You can't discipline a little baby. You got to wait till they start knowing something. You just got to let them scream their heads off and give them a bottle or whatever you do. But you're not spanking a little kid because the kid's crying when it's an infant. That's child abuse. When the kid gets a certain age, then you start to do the discipline. Don't touch the stove. Don't do this. Don't do that. And they do it anyway. Well, then you've got to give a little trial and a little discipline to them. God does the same thing. So if you're positive to doctrine, you're going to reach stage A, which is a freshman. And then you move forward to stage B, which is a sophomore. Then you move to stage C, which you're a junior. Now D, you're a senior, and then you can go to graduate school. And that's the land up here that's reserved for only the top, top believers. Now, God wants everybody in this room to be a top, top believer. In fact, He's already designed all your blessings and put them into a bank account. To prove that He wants you to be a top believer, He's already done it all. Before the foundations of the world, Ephesians chapter 1, He says, I've put all your blessings for time and eternity in an escrow account. So it's not my fault you don't get it. It's your fault. Because I want you to be at the very top before you die. Sadly, most believers never get out of the gate. They're born again, and that's it. They have no desire to learn Bible doctrine. And you might say, well, what's the problem? The problem is them. They say, well, Bible doctrine doesn't work. I tried it for 2 weeks. No, it works great. You don't work is the problem. You don't work. And everybody has their hobbies. And they can tell you all about their hobbies. This, that, the other thing. Ask them something about Bible doctrine. Goose eggs. Nothing. Oh, they can say, I love Jesus. But what's the evidence of it? So you go from A to B to C. And along the way, you have testing, of course. And we know that. And God will, the testing is for the purpose of getting you to the next level. And so it's a wonderful ride if you want to take the ride. And as Christ said, my burden is light. So yes, it takes some effort. This takes thousands of decisions to get to here. You've got to decide over the course of your life, what's more important to me? Learning doctrine or fill in the blank? And whatever your blank is, it's nothingness. But you think it's important, but it's really nothing. And if you think about it, who gave you the ability to even enjoy the things that you think are more important than Bible doctrine? God did. He has a marvelous sense of humor. So the stuff that you enjoy, the stuff that you have, where do you think it came from? It came from the hand of God. And so that's Solomon's problem. Solomon, of course, was a believer. And as a young man, he was very positive to doctrine. He probably got up to level C. And then he turned against it. And what turned him against doctrine? The pleasures of the world. All the good stuff turned him against it. And we studied this already. And he became psycho in his soul. People that try to interpret Ecclesiastics, unless you realize the doctrine of reversionism, you can't figure Ecclesiastics out. But if you understand the doctrine of reversionism, it's easy. It's easy. He was a positive believer, and then he turned his back against Bible doctrine. And you're going to say, who, me? Yeah, you. That will be the story of all of us in this room. You will turn against Bible doctrine if you haven't already. And then you'll come back to it, hopefully. Some of you never will come back. You'll crash and burn. And then you'll be evaluated at the judgment seat of Christ. The good news is, though, if you get up to C before you crash and burn, you'll be rewarded at C. Just because you crashed all the way back down to here and you're a walking zombie, God in His grace will reward you at the highest level you got to when you did get to it. So Saul, for example, he got to a pretty high level, maybe B. Then he turned his back on it and he died the sin unto death. He died a miserable, horrible death. He lived a miserable, horrible life after he turned against doctrine. But he'll be in heaven. He'll be rewarded at B. It's called grace. A lot of people don't like that. Well, that's not fair. Yes, it's called grace. If you got what you deserved, you would be incinerated. And I include myself in that concept. So God in His grace, of course, allowed Solomon to progress here. He allowed Solomon to fall back. And He did not take away from Solomon all the blessings that Solomon had. A lot of people, when they accumulate things, they say, well, if I'm not a good boy or girl, God's going to take it away from me. No, He won't. Because in his sense of humor, all the things that Solomon had made him totally miserable. He hated it, and yet he couldn't let it go. And one of the things that Solomon really had a huge desire in his soul was for a wife. He wanted to have the perfect spouse, and he never got the perfect spouse. We're going to study Song of Solomon next, where God introduces him to the woman he could have had, but he didn't get her. So we'll see that when we get to Song of Solomon. So he says right here, chapter 4, then I looked again at the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So this is he's seeing injustice in the world. He's seeing people getting nailed, cheated, robbed. He said, boy, that's not right. Well, why is that occurring? Well, we know why it occurs. Why is there sin in the world? because of the angelic conflict. And he knew these things, but he's forgetting the Bible doctrine. Therefore, it seems so unfair to him that these things cannot be corrected. And therefore, he comes to the conclusion, everything's pointless. Well, without Bible doctrine, if you're a believer, it is pointless. You're right. Verse 2, so I congratulated the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still living. So he says, it's better to be dead. This world is so miserable, it's so unfair, it's so nasty, so disgusting. The dead have it better off. We'll see later on where he doesn't want to die. Because, again, he's schizophrenic. A believer that rejects Bible doctrine gets very schizophrenic in their thinking. They're not logical at all. They're not rational at all. 3, but better off than both of them is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun. So now he's really getting under the bizarro thinking. Well, it's just better if I never existed. You know, in other words, it's God's fault. God, why'd you allow all this stuff? It's just horrible. It sounds like our grandparents, right? Remember Adam and Eve? Adam, at his trial, said, it's your fault that I sinned, God. The woman you gave me caused me to do it. This is just an arrogant person. It's better that nobody ever existed, and therefore, because there's so much suffering and evil and things in the world. This is just not logical thinking. It's non compos mentis. 4, and you might have had this thought once in a while, it's better if I'd never been born. But you don't really mean it, but you say it. My life is so bad, it's just I wish I hadn't been born. Why was I born? Well, it's called the grace of God. Verse 4, I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is a result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity and striving after wind. Well, yeah, there's a lot of that out there. People are in competition with each other all the time. Why? Well, the old sin nature. Neighbor's got this, I want that. Somebody has this. Sometimes what motivates people is they're jealous of somebody else and they're going to go out and one-up them, whatever it is. And you've seen it and I've seen it. And they say, oh, I'm so happy for you. They're not really happy for you. That's just what they tell you to their face. They hate you for it, that you got their promotion and they didn't. If you could really get inside their brain, you would see a whole different bunch of verbs popping around their head as they congratulate you and wish you would drop dead at the same time. It's just human nature. It's the old sin nature. It's not a sin to be tempted if you have the same thoughts. You say, okay, well, that's interesting, but I'm not going to follow it. So there's a lot of hypocrisy, and so he's recognizing this. It's very true, very true. 5, the fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Yes, that's what the fool does. And this is Solomon himself. You fold your hand and you consume your own flesh. Folding the hand basically is an idiom for you do nothing, and yet you're destroying yourself. And this is the fool. Verse 6, one hand full of rest is better than two fists full of labor in striving after wind. In other words, you say, well, what's the point of it all? I'm just not going to do anything. You know, I'll just sit here and let other people row the boat. I'm just going to sit here and do nothing. Because what's the point? Suppose I do all these wonderful things. What does it all mean? Then later on we're going to see that he says, well, we've already seen it before. He's going to come back to it. You know, all the things I've accumulated, when I'm dead, somebody else gets it. So why should I even do it? Okay, so then he says, 7, then I looked again at vanity under the sun. There was a certain man without a dependent, having neither a son nor a brother. Yet there was no end to all his labor. Indeed, his eyes were not satisfied with riches, and he never asked, and for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of pleasure? This too is vanity, and it is a grievous task. So he sees a man here that has no offspring, nobody to leave all the money to, and yet he's working all the time, all the time, all the time. Well, why are you working all the time? Who are you going to leave it to? Because you don't even have any kids. You don't have a brother. You have nobody. So who's going to get it? So Solomon said, this is vanity. Why doesn't that person just not work so hard? Just do it, just stop working so hard. He said, it's vanity. You're an idiot if you're working so hard for nothing. 2, verse 9, 2 are better than 1 because they have a good return for their labor. For if either of them fails, the one will lift up his companion, But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. Now, this is a new, when you have a little bold on your nine, he's changing his thoughts. That's a whole new thought here. He said, and this is a whole new category. What's the truth? It's better to have two people working at something because if one's tired, then the other one can take over. So if you're out there doing a particular task, it's good to have someone helping you with the dishes or, you know, doing this or doing that. Because one of them gets hurt, the other one can finish the task. And this is a true factor of capitalism. You know, having two people working together is good in a general principle. Furthermore, verse 11, if two lie down together, they keep warm. And how can one be warm alone? Well, if you've ever been on a cold night and you crawl into bed with your spouse, you know, it's like having a thermos or something. You can keep warm. 12, and if one can overpower him who is alone, two can resist him. A cord of three strands is not quickly torn apart. Yeah, so if you're going to get into a fist fight, better to have two of you because you might come out better in that context. And then the strands, of course, you know, one cord can be broken. You get two or three, four, five, six cords, then you have a rope and it's harder to break. 13, a poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. That's true. You always want to be open to new ideas, but this king here is foolish because he's not open to receive instruction. He doesn't know how to receive instruction. And yet the poor and wise lad is better because the wise lad is someone that has information and can discern the information. 14, for he has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. And this is true, because as a metaphor, if you're wise, you can be a king. You don't have to be a king to be a king. And coming out of the prison, of course, is all of us come out of a prison of no knowledge. If you have no knowledge, you're in prison. I'll prove it to you. If you have your car and something happens, you have no knowledge about what to do with the car, you got to take it to somebody. To the extent that you don't know how to fix stuff in the house yourself, then you're paying out a lot of money just to JoJo to come over and fix it for you. Well, what if you know how to fix it yourself? You're in a prison. You're dependent on other people. Prisoners are dependent on other people. So the less you know how to do, the more you're dependent on other people to do it for you. And therefore, the more you can do it yourself, you are the king of your own surroundings instead of the prisoner. I have seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. Everybody likes a winner. Everybody likes a winner. And that's normal. That's a good idea. Someone that has a better idea. 16, there's no end to all the people, to all who were before them, and even the ones who will come later will not be happy with him, for this too is vanity and striving after the wind. Even the person that they like, they will soon kick him to the curb and find somebody else. Remember in Solomon's day, there was hundreds of thousands of people in Jerusalem, and there are graveyards everywhere, and all these people are dead, and he said, there's a lot of people before me that are dead. Most of the graveyards, you know, you're just walking across dead people all over this country. We might be sitting on top of a lot of dead burial grounds, particularly in Europe. They planted a lot of people, but after about 200-300 years, the graves get knocked down, this, that, and the other thing, and same in the Middle East. I mean, there's been millions and millions and millions of humans that have died, and millions have come after them, and they'll all die, and then millions and millions. If you ever watch TV shows from the 50s, you could say, that person's dead. That person's dead. The dogs are dead in the movie. The horses are all dead. Everything I see in this movie is dead. Dead. And you see all sorts of people in the movie. I wonder where they're all buried. I wonder where, you know, where all the dogs and horses and all that stuff, all dead, all gone. And so he's saying that even if you're successful and people flock to you, you're going to be dead. Now, these are all true things. And without Bible doctrine, yes, there is no hope. And without Bible doctrine, there's no hope for the unbeliever, the gospel. There's no hope for the believer to reach maturity. Your attitude towards God. Verse 5, guard your steps as you go to the house of God and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know they are doing evil. Now we see Solomon, of course, has he still has Bible doctrine in his soul, but it's all covered up with scar tissue. But every once in a while, it pops up in Ecclesiastes, and this is one of those places where he's realizing the importance of Bible doctrine. When it says, go to the house of God, this tells us that the temple has been built already. So it kind of dates this. He's writing this as an older person. The temple's been built. And Jews, of course, would go into the temple to worship in the ritual age of the Old Testament. So guard your steps and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools. Underline the word listen. That's what it's all about. You got to listen, because a sacrifice without knowledge is worthless. Many of the Jews in Jesus' day, they did all the rituals and the sacrifices. They didn't know what it stood for because nobody listened. And to grow to maturity, you've got to listen. And that's what he's saying. Listen rather than offer the sacrifice of fools. Fools just offer the sacrifice. I'm done. I did my thing. My nod to God. I went to church on Sunday, and I'm good till next Sunday. Did you learn anything? No. Well, of course, you can't learn anything because they don't teach anything. But I had a good time. Yeah, I kind of had a good time. All sorts of stuff. I'm going to go to a friendly church and do this and do that. They don't listen. They don't want to listen. So they're offering the sacrifice of fools. God's not interested in you just showing up and doing a nod to God. He's interested in positive volition in your soul. For they do not know that they're doing evil. They're going to the house of God. They're doing the sacrifice, but it's evil. All evil. The doctrine of good and evil is in your book. It's evil. Because evil is anything that's outside of agathos, which is divine good. And evil involves these hypocrites. They wear the robes, they do all these things, they're trying to impress other people how godly they are. They're not impressing, well, they do impress a lot of people, but they don't impress God. Do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God, for God is in heaven and you are on the earth. Therefore, let your words be few. This is great advice. Remember, Solomon still had his IQ of a genius. God did not take that away from him. This is great advice. Do not jump in, and when in doubt, don't say anything. And God knows, of course, all your thoughts and all these things. God knows everything about it. And let your words be few, because the sins of the tongue are horrible sins, and they can do great destruction, what comes out of your mouth. 3, for the dream comes through much effort and the voice of a fool through many words. So the dream, of course, are subconscious thoughts, and they're dreaming in their subconscious, but they're also living in a dream themselves. They're living in unreality. They're not living in reality. If they're living in reality, they'd be learning Bible doctrine. They're living in a dream. What's a dream? You might daydream. Well, daydream once in a while. Well, I'm the king, and I'm doing this, I'm doing that, or whatever. Yes, these are nice little things to dream about. Or you might dream, you know, I'm an NBA superstar, and I make this shot. Or you might dream, I've got this, I got that. But you're not living in reality. They might be pleasant, but it's not reality. And then it comes through much effort. So you're dreaming all this time, you're daydreaming. You're ghost walking, daydreaming through life. You've created the God of your own imagination. I daydream that God is this, that, and the other thing. And therefore, I will do these things. And the voice of a fool through many words. So, you know, you're daydreaming in your mind, and you're blabbing nonsense out of your mouth. You're a fool, because you do not understand the God of reality. You create a God of your own daydreams. And that's not God. Your God is like Santa Claus. If I'm just sincere, if I'm good, if I love everybody, if I treat everybody with kindness and respect, then God will love me more. And I'll get rewards. You're a fool. So you put out these many, many words about all sorts of stuff that are meaningless. But the wise man says, you know, I don't really know that much about God. I'm still learning. And therefore, as I progress up here, the more I learn, the more I can use wisdom. And of course, people love to give advice to other people. Most people hate advice. And they really hate good advice. So a fool, you're not going to change their mind if you give them advice. And a wise person doesn't need your advice. Right? Right. So therefore, just don't give it unless they ask you. Unless somebody asks you, hey, what do you think about this? Don't give them any advice because it's offensive to the arrogant person. They don't want it. And of course, if they want advice, they would ask you for it. And everybody's got advice. Everybody's got opinions and advice about what to do and how to do it and when to do it. And I'm going to tell you all these things. Verse 4, when you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. Now, the vows here is part of the Old Testament rituals. You can make. Remember, Paul went in to make a vow. A vow. And he got in trouble. It was part of the Old Testament rituals. They would make vows and dedications. I dedicate this. And they'd have all sorts of things. And, of course, if you do it, then do it. So you might make a vow. Lord, I'm going to learn Bible doctrine. Well, that's a good vow to make. I'm going to do my best to learn Bible doctrine. That's a good vow to make. So do it. God doesn't want to hear your lip service. Oh, God, I'm interested in you. Really? He knows what you're really thinking. Verse 5, it is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. 6, do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? So again, do not let your speech cause you to sin. Okay, do not let your speech cause you to sin. Sins of the tongue. Use few words, not a lot of words. And again, there's nothing wrong with having conversations. This doesn't mean, well, I'm not supposed to have conversations about, you know, a subject that interests you. That's fine. But this talks about arrogance and judging other people and violating their privacy and all those things. And then, of course, we do not say in the presence of a messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? In other words, I made a vow, but now the messenger of God will be a prophet or a priest. It was a mistake. I really shouldn't have done that. A man in general is only as good as his word. This applies to the lady of word as well. If you give your word, you got to keep your word. If you don't keep your word, you're no damn good. And this is just the laws of divine establishment. You want to be known as someone that keeps their word. Even an unbeliever wants to do that. So my advice is, if you don't want to give your word, then don't give your word. If you don't want to keep your word, then don't give your word. But if you give your word is your bond, and it binds you. Even if you don't want to do it, you made a bad deal. Oh, well, you eat peanut butter sandwiches for 5 years till you can dig yourself out of the bad deal that you made. And that's just the way it goes. So if your word's no good, you're no good. That's not that hard to figure out. People don't want to say, well, that person, they gave their word all the time. They never keep it. No one's going to deal with you. You want to have the reputation. They gave their word. So don't give your word is my advice, unless you're committed to keeping your word come hell or high water. You can get around that solution. Just don't give your word. But a lot of people give their word. I'll be there at 6 o'clock. Well, you just gave your word, and you're not there at 6. Well, then you're not reliable. I'll do this for you. Then you don't do it. Well, you know, something came up. I'm sure it did. It was inconvenient for you to keep your word. In other words, let me translate it for you. You were going to be inconvenienced by keeping your word. Everybody keeps their word if it's convenient or it benefits them. But if it's going to be hard on you, that's the people that don't want to keep their word. So that's a critical concept that he's correct in. 7, for in many dreams and in many words, there's emptiness. Rather, respect God. In many dreams, in many words, there's emptiness. All your daydreaming doesn't amount to diddly squat, but rather respect God. How do you respect God? You do what he tells you to do. What does he tell me to do? Learn my word. 3 words, learn my word. 8, if you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight, for one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. So he's talking about the divine institutions now. We got a new thought. See, the 8, there's a bold thing. We're moving on to a new subject. We're saying that, yes, there's no such thing as a perfect society. We see liberals in this country, they want a perfect society. They want utopianism. It's impossible because people are imperfect. So if you see one crooked judge, they're not all crooked. And there's a system where ultimately these things can be hashed out because there's appellate systems and it goes up and up and up. And The bottom line is, verse 9, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. This is a smart king. If you have smart leaders that understand the divine institutions, we all prosper. As, might I just say, our current executive cultivates the land properly. Now, this is not a brief for the current president, but he does understand these divine institutions. More so than any president I've seen in my lifetime, and I'm talking about Ronald Reagan. He understands these concepts. We've had presidents in the past that hate these concepts. The opposite of privacy, of course, is the big state. The opposite of marriage between a man and a woman is marry anything you want. Opposite of family, where you raise kids, the state will raise them in the schools. Opposite of nationalism, internationalism. And you know we've had presidents that have not cultivated the land, and therefore the whole thing suffers. So yes, we have an imperfect society. We have an imperfect president. We got an imperfect Congress. We got imperfect courts. But God controls history. And the more that our society will adhere to these laws of the divine institutions, the more we will prosper. The less they adhere to it, the more we will not prosper. And that's what Solomon is recognizing. With our head bowed and our eyes closed, Father, we thank you for the privilege of studying your holy word this morning. We pray that God the Holy Spirit will challenge us by these things. In Christ's name, amen.